From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Jennifer Finney Borlan, a prominent voice in the LGBTQ rights movement. She's written extensively about her life as a transgender woman and has been writing about her life during the pandemic in her New York Times column. Borlan came out as trans in her 40s, and then the woman she was married to had to adjust to being married to a woman. They have two children and have been wife and wife longer than they've been husband and wife. Borlan has a new memoir about seven phases of her life and the dog she had during each phase. She's been a consultant on two TV series, Transparent and I Am Kate, about Caitlyn Jenner. Later, Ken Tucker reviews a new album he describes as something fresh and much needed by Grammy winner Dua Lipa. If you're interested in issues related to gender or dogs, I think you'll be interested in what my guest Jennifer Finney Borlan has to say. She's a prominent voice in the LGBTQ movement and has written extensively about being a trans woman. In her new memoir, she writes that in her early life, when she was living as a boy, then as a man, there were times she found it impossible to express the thing that was in her heart. But the love she felt for dogs was one she never had to hide. And when she felt unlovable, that didn't stop her dogs from loving her. The memoir is called Good Boy, My Life in Seven Dogs, which she describes as a book about the seven phases of her life and the dogs she loved at each moment. Borlan writes an op-ed column published in the New York Times on alternate Wednesdays, in which she's lately been writing about how the pandemic is affecting her life. She was an advisor on two TV series, Transparent and I Am Kate, about Caitlyn Jenner. From 2013 to 17, she co-chaired the board of directors of the LGBTQ rights group GLAAD. Borlan is the inaugural Anna Quinlan Writer in Residence at Barnard College of Columbia University. Jennifer Finney Borlan, welcome back to Fresh Air. How are you and your family?
Well, we're doing well enough. I think in this isolation period, people find themselves either too alone or too crowded in with the rest of their family. And we are definitely in the latter camp. There are five of us right now in the house. My wife, my daughter, her fiance, and my brother-in-law. And every day is like Thanksgiving dinner.
And how many dogs do you have now?
We're down to one right now, which I guess is a blessing, because, you know, because they get old, and the older they get, the more trouble they are. Actually, they're trouble when they're young, too. I take that back. They're always trouble, but that's why we love them.
So at the beginning of the pandemic, you were in New York teaching at Barnard, but then Barnard, like so many colleges, shut down their classes. So you move back to your, you know, more full-time home in rural Maine. You live in New York just during the spring semester when you teach at Barnard. Can you talk a little bit about the differences between your experience of the pandemic in New York versus rural Maine?
Well, of course, I left New York City when things were just starting. I was scheduled to come back home here to Maine for spring break. So when things began in New York City, it was really very early. But you could see it in people's faces. It's a crowded place. People are trying to avoid each other. There was really this element of fear. And here in Maine, I really don't see that many people. There's one member of the family. My wife is the one who's going to the grocery store. And when she does, she puts on a mask. She goes out once a week at most if she can. Except for today, when she had to take the dog to the vet, actually. But that's a different story.
What's wrong with your dog?
Well, the dog has started peeing on the couch, and it's worrisome. We don't know if she's just upset or if something else is going wrong. And going to the vet is weird, too, because we have to arrange to go to the vet, open the door, let the dog out. They come out, they grab the dog. So we have to hand off the dog without any human contact. So it's all weird.
So in your New York Times column, you wrote about an incident on the subway in New York just before you left New York for your home in rural Maine. And, you know, a guy comes in on the subway car and starts ranting. Tell us what he was saying,
right,
and what impact that had on you.
You know, a ranting person on the subway. It's not that unusual. But this particular day, this man got on the subway and he started screaming about the coronavirus, and he was blaming it on gay people, although that was not the phrase that he used. And he was just kind of screaming and yelling about how we were all going to get sick and how it was all to be blamed on LGBTQ people. And we got to, I think it was Penn Station, and just the car emptied. People just ran out of the car. But for some reason, I stayed. Maybe it was that I just kind of wanted to look him in the eye, or maybe it's just that I don't know, maybe I've lived in New York too long, and I was sitting down and I didn't want to get up. But he looked at me and I looked at him, and, you know, I don't know what people see when they look at me. I think, and this is the issue of passing, which is a highly volatile one within not just the trans community, but in all, you know, communities of people who are protected as long as people perceive us as not being different. But as soon as people do perceive our difference, then we can really feel endangered. And so most of the time when people look at me, they see a middle-aged woman. But not always. Sometimes when I open my mouth, people can tell my history, which I admit makes me a little sad, but it is what it is. Anyway, this guy looked at me and he said, "I'm sorry, I'm just scared." And, you know, I didn't reply, but I just kind of thought about that. I wondered, he's not behaving well, but he's not so different from, it's not so different from the way I feel. We're all scared. But that was the day it really hit me. That was the day I knew that the world had changed.
I know you're in touch with a lot of people who are trans. Do you think that there are particular health issues now or health insurance issues facing people who are trans in this period of the pandemic?
Well, I think the trans community is a pretty large community, and there are a lot of different people in the community. And yet, I think as a whole, we have a lot of people who are unemployed because people have reservations about hiring people who are trans. And because we're not employed, or we're self-employed, or people are doing sex work, we don't have health insurance. So there are all sorts of ways in which transgender people are at the margins, and a crisis like this hits people at the margins first.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jennifer Finney Boylan. Her new memoir is called Good Boy, My Life in Seven Dogs. Why did you want to frame your life in terms of the dogs you had during each stage of it?
I think there are a couple reasons. One of the things I wanted to write about was this question of what it means to be a woman who had a boyhood. And I want to be really respectful and careful, because there are a number of transgender women who would take issue with my using that phrase, having had a boyhood. There are many people who feel that they always were who they are, and to refer to an earlier part of your life differently is really disrespectful. But even though I respect that view, for me, I came out and transitioned in my 40s. And so, I mean, I always knew who I was, but the rest of the world didn't know it. And so I had a kind of period of socialization and walked through the world appearing to be male. So I had this experience, and it's an experience that I now struggle to connect to. And so that's the question. What does it mean to be a woman who had a boyhood? And it struck me that dogs provided the perfect way of talking about that experience, because I had a different dog at each of the different moments of my earlier life. So there was the dog that I had when I was a boy. There was a dog for when I was a teenager, and there was one for when I was a cool college boy, and there was one for when I was a husband and a boyfriend and a father. And so in some ways it's a memoir of masculinity, kind of told the way an expatriate might speak of the country of their birth. There are times when I struggle to remember what it was like to live in that world. But then I remember the dogs, and it becomes really clear.
Maybe I'm wrong about this, but it seems to me when we think about dogs and gender, we don't necessarily think so much about the dog's actual gender. What we think about is if it's a male kind of dog or a female kind of dog. In other words, like the cute, fluffy dogs are usually considered like dogs for women and girls. And like the larger, short-haired, you know, dogs are often considered a more like male dog.
The and kind so, that would bite you. The kind that would bite you is the man's dog. Yes, there and it's there's not just dog people and cat people in the world. There's also big dogs and little dog people. And we've had big dogs for virtually my entire life.
Yeah,
right.
So you've
well,
had
my
like...
wife and I are having this conversation right now. As the dog that we have right now gets older and older, and I've begun the dreaded conversation of, you know, maybe have we thought about getting another dog? Maybe we should get a puppy. And my wife kind of looks at me like, well, one, you're crazy because we're not doing this again. And two, if we were to get another dog, how about like a little dog, a city dog? Well, to me, a little dog, you know, I can't say I'd rather have no dog than a little dog. But, you know, I've always had these kind of giant monsters. And I don't know. So is that a residual thing from my earlier life that I want the big dog? I don't know.
During your boyhood, as you describe it, did you like having dogs that were perceived by the world as masculine dogs?
Well, you know, I didn't think of it that way. I mean, I had a very tenuous relationship with masculinity back then anyhow. I mean, no one would have ever mistaken me for Tom Brady when I was young. My main hobbies were raising seahorses and growing Venus flytraps. And the dogs that we had, I mean, I think I had this image of myself as like, you know, with Timmy and Lassie, but I was no Timmy, and the dogs that we had were definitely not Lassie. I mean, the first dog we had was this mulish, snarling, resentful Dalmatian who was named, and I can't believe we named the dog this, Playboy. But then, you know, my family had a very strange tradition when it came to naming the pets. We also had a cat that my sister named, and this is the actual name of the cat, Baboing. And you had to say it like that, Baboing. And how did this happen? I even can't tell you. But I also know that one of the saddest and weirdest days of my young life was the school bus that I was about to get on one day ran over Baboing, or glanced the cat as it ran across the road. So I had to get on the school bus and went to school, and my mother took the cat to the vet, and there's my mother standing at the vet's with this semi-flattened cat in her arms, and the vet said, "What's the name of this cat?" And my mother, my poor mother, had to look him in the eyes and say, "Baboing." So I don't know. Playboy was not Lassie. Playboy was not even Rin Tin Tin. Playboy would steal the Thanksgiving turkey off the table and chase after motorcycles and bite your friends. So, you know, it was a difficult relationship. However, the one person in the world who loved Playboy without reservation, and the feeling was mutual, was my father. That he would just get down on the floor and ask that question that has haunted me my entire life. Who's a good boy? Who's a good boy? And I remember being very jealous in some ways of that dog, because my father could love this horrible dog without condition. Whereas for me, it was harder because, you know, I didn't know who was a good boy, but I knew it wasn't me.
So you tell a story about one of your dogs who was always acting up, was overly sexualized, would hump everybody and everything, would knock down visitors, peed everywhere. But if you tried to tell this dog no, he would just bark. And neutering didn't change things. So you took him to the vet. And the vet said he needs better training, but that there was an experimental hormone therapy you could try. But the vet gave you a warning about how this would change the dog's behavior, that the dog would never be the same dog again. And then you thought about...
Yeah.
You thought about maybe you should take the hormone. So, like, how old were you, and what did you know about hormone therapy? And tell me what was going through your mind then.
We tried to help Matt the Mutt, but nothing we did would help. So we took him to the vet, and the vet said, well, you should train the dog, but here's this experimental protocol. You could have, there was some female hormone, which was supposed to feminize the dog. I remember the vet saying the phrase, he might not be the same dog afterwards. And I remember thinking, so what, he's going to not ask for directions if he is going out to some other dog's house or something? And anyway, I was given this sample of female dog hormones or something. And I'm driving home, and so I'm thinking, you know, the vet has just slipped me the female hormones that I've been hoping for. Because I knew that hormone therapy was a thing that transgender women could take to be restored to themselves. But I also knew that probably I shouldn't be taking the dog's medication. I don't know what that would have done to me. But I thought about it. I really thought about it. I thought, well, I could. What if I took just one? I don't know. Maybe I would have gotten fleas or something. But I threw them in the trash in the end. I thought, no, I can't do this. This is just too crazy. Even for me, this is too crazy. And I came in, and my mother said, how'd it go? And I said, you know, the doctor says we should take him to dog school, which we did, and which had no effect.
How old were you?
I think I was 20. I think this was my senior year at Wesleyan.
So you wanted to take female hormones at that point. You wanted to transition, but felt that you couldn't. And if you did anything, it had to be through subterfuge and secrecy, like taking your dog's hormone pills, which you ultimately decided not to do. So what was that like for you?
It just didn't seem like a careful protocol. In those days, coming out as transgender was unknown territory. At least it was for me. You know, I barely even had a word for the thing that I felt. And as much as I knew I wanted to live my true life, I also felt that if I lived that life, it would almost surely lead to a life of marginality, of violence, and that I just thought I might well be killed. That there was no place in the world in which I could live. There was no place in the world for me to be. So the idea, the idea of taking dog hormones was probably a non-starter, but even if I'd gone to a doctor and been given the chance to take the medication that I needed, I probably still would have been very reluctant to do it because I was just too afraid, and I thought I'd be wrecking the rest of my life. I thought I would never be loved by anyone except for maybe my dog. I thought that I would never have a family. I would never have a job. It seemed like my best life might well cost me my life. So, you know, I soldiered on, hoping that it would all get better. I also had this belief that love would cure me. I felt that if I were loved deeply enough by someone else, that it would help me get out of myself. And I know that seems like a silly thing to believe, but I think it's very human, and it's not only transgender people who believe that a great love will transform them into the person that they want to be instead of who they are. And the fact that it rarely succeeds, that particular philosophy, doesn't mean that it's any less understandable or human.
Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jennifer Finney Boylan. Her new memoir is called Good Boy, My Life in Seven Dogs. She writes extensively about being a transgender woman, including in her New York Times column, which is published every other Wednesday. We'll be back after we take a short break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With Capital One, a new savings account earns 5 times the national average. That's 5 times more savings toward that overdue home addition, or maybe even an addition on that addition. Capital One is helping you earn more towards your savings goals. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One N.A. Member FDIC.
My guest is Jennifer Finney Borland, who's a prominent voice in the LGBTQ movement and has written extensively about being a trans woman. Her new memoir is called Good Boy, My Life in 7 Dogs, which she describes as a book about the 7 phases of her life and the dogs she loved at each moment. She writes an op-ed column published in the New York Times on alternate Wednesdays, in which she's lately been writing about how the pandemic is affecting her life. She was an advisor on 2 TV series, Transparent and I Am Kate, about Caitlyn Jenner, and she's the former co-chair of the board of directors of the LGBTQ rights group GLAAD. She's the inaugural Anna Quindlen Writer-in-Residence at Barnard College of Columbia University. And when she's not teaching during the spring semester, she lives in rural Maine, where she's talking to us from now. So you didn't come out as trans until after you'd been married for probably over a decade, I think around 12 years, and married to a woman. So you were considered by the world and considered by your wife to be a straight couple. What was the turning point for you in deciding that you had to become you, that you had to address who you thought your authentic self was?
Well, it was not exactly one day. It was less of a decision than like an erosion, maybe. I was determined to make the best of the situation. That's all the only way I can describe it, because I thought that coming out as trans was just going to be too hard a life to live. But I remember there was one day when a barrier came down at a railroad crossing, and it was snowing. This was probably January of 2000. So it was the new millennium. I remember that. It felt like we were in a new era. And I just watched the cars of the freight train going by and started kind of daydreaming and thinking that question, how long are you going to wait before you live your actual life? Eventually the barrier went up, the train disappeared down the tracks, but I was just sitting there in my car in this kind of daze until cars behind me started honking and wondering what was wrong with me. So that was the day I came home and I said to my wife, you know, I think I want to get back into therapy. We had talked a little bit about the gender question before that moment, but that was the moment that I thought, you know, I cannot keep living a life in which I'm not really myself.
What was your wife's reaction?
Well, she's a social worker, so her first reaction was, well, good, therapy is a good thing. She wanted me to be happy, but she also felt, once it became clear that transition was coming right ahead, then she had a dilemma where she had to think, well, I have to help the person that I love most in the world at this moment of their crisis, right? But in so doing, I might lose the person that I love. And it's kind of an unsolvable dilemma. And yet here we are, still together, after 32 years of marriage now, 12 as husband and wife, and 20 as wife and wife.
Did she feel that she lost the person who she loved? Did she feel that you became a different person?
I think she felt that way early on. And to be honest, like a lot of trans women in transition, I kind of went into this pink cloud for a little bit. And I was experiencing all the things that I'd wanted to experience but had never been able to be. So, you know, I wore a lot of makeup. I was a real girly girl for a little bit. And I went to a voice therapist who had me speaking in this very feminine voice. And I was taught how to have my sentences go up at the end of every sentence so that I would sound more female. And so I was, I really did spend a time as a kind of an annoying person, actually. And I think my wife was very concerned about that. In time, as I got used to my new body and my new self, I became a little bit more androgynous again, and my voice fell back down here. So in a funny way, I came back to myself and we came back to each other in that way. Although now as two women.
When you were more girly, when you first transitioned, were you more, quote, feminine than your wife was?
I'm not sure. I certainly got more pleasure out of it. I was essentially going through a second adolescence at age 40, and a lot of the kind of trial and error things that girls go through and women go through when they're 5 and 10 and 15 were things that I was having to figure out. And even now, there are some things that I'm still trying to figure out, like doing a French braid. Like, I don't know, I'm 61. I begin to think that ship has sailed. I'm probably never going to learn how to do that now. And then there are other things I was told about things that women do that now I had to do, like I wasn't allowed to have baby back ribs anymore. Like that was a new federal law that women only are allowed to have a little salad. And I just kind of remember thinking, really? Okay, I guess I'll have a little salad. I mean, I'm making fun of that, although, in fact, I do worry about food issues now in a way that I didn't pre-transition. But that's a whole other story, I guess.
Tell me more about that story.
Well, I just, you know, now, I mean, it's so insane. I think to live in this culture means that you're constantly being influenced by what the culture wants you to be. And if you're a woman, it means you're supposed to be thin. You're supposed to care about how pretty you are. You're supposed to care about a lot of things that maybe you shouldn't care about as much as the culture says you ought. And as a feminist, and I was a feminist before, obviously, I struggled with it because I felt, so to be a woman in this culture means to, I think what I was struggling with was fitting in. That, you know, I felt like, well, if I'm going to be a woman, do I have to be the kind of woman who I like least? Does that mean that I have to be counting every calorie and kind of constantly deferring to men and constantly being subservient in some ways? I think there's a way in which I felt, well, if I want to fit in, if I want to pass in the world, then this is all the junk that I have to do. And it took me a while before I realized, actually, no, you can fight against that stuff. You've gone to all this trouble to become female. Why would you become anything less than the person you want to be? Even if that means being a little more androgynous. But the problem is, if I act a little bit more androgynously now, then people might be able to see that I'm trans when they look at me or when they hear my voice. You know, in some ways, it's kind of like being a teenager still, where you're always wondering, what will other people think of me?
And if people think you're trans, do you perceive that as a problem because of discrimination against trans people or because you just don't want to be perceived as trans?
Well, I don't mind being perceived as trans, but it depends on the situation. There are some situations where I can really be put in danger. But I have to say, over the last 20 years since transition, of the times that I felt in danger, most of them have not been because I was trans. Most of them have been because I was female. It's the experience of walking home alone late at night in a strange city and hearing footsteps behind me. It's the experience of, you know, I used to play out with a band and having people kind of come up to me after the concert and kind of coming on to me and not taking no for an answer. So that's been more of an issue for me than being trans.
Let me reintroduce you here. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jennifer Finney Boylan. Her new memoir is called Good Boy, My Life in 7 Dogs. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor State Farm. State Farm fits seamlessly into your life, allowing you to easily manage your coverage, pay your bill, and even file a claim with the State Farm mobile app. And they really get to know you. Thanks to a network of 19,000 agents, you'll have someone local to talk you through options that fit your personal needs. When you want the real deal, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
We live in a culture that prizes action. But now, former Surgeon General Vivek Murthy says it's important to make space to just be.
Simply spending 5 minutes just listening to the birds chirping or to the conversation around you.
Solitude and ways to overcome loneliness on the next Hidden Brain from NPR.
Let's get back to my interview with Jennifer Finney Boylan, who's written extensively about her life as a transgender woman. Her new memoir is called Good Boy, My Life and Seven Dogs. It's about seven stages of her life and the dogs she had in each of those stages. So one of the big surprises of your life is, you know, you raised two sons, and then when one of your sons was, I guess, in his 20s, he told you that he was going to transition to being a woman. And you had, like, no clue, apparently, that he was thinking about that. What was it like to hear your son tell you that he was going to become your daughter? Because you went through this with your own mother. You know, you were on the other end of it.
Yeah, I want to be careful because I want to protect my daughter's privacy to some degree here.
Yes.
But I'll simply say that when I came out as trans, my expectation was that people should be happy for me. And I knew it was asking a lot of people, but I still had the hope that people would understand that I was doing a difficult thing that was necessary, that would enable me to survive in the world. Later, when my own child came out as trans, I was surprised at how much I struggled, at least at first, with it. And I suddenly had this insight into what I'd been asking other people, and including my own mother, to understand. And in the end, I think I was glad for her, and I love my daughter, and I'm really proud of her. But it's funny how I think having me as a parent didn't make my daughter's transition easier. In some ways, I think it may have made it harder. We have a lot of our dreams tied up in our children, and it is hard to understand the obvious, which is that your children aren't here to live your dreams. Your children are here to live theirs. When I came out to my own mother 20 years ago, she was 85, she was an evangelical Christian, she was a Republican, and I had a pretty good sense that my coming out as trans was not going to strike her as the greatest thing that had ever happened to her. And yet, I came out to her, I told her the story, and I started to cry. And she got up out of her chair, and she put her arms around me, and she said, "I would never turn my back on my child. I will always love you." And I said, "But Mom, won't it be a scandal when everyone finds out that I'm your daughter now?" And she said, "Well, quite frankly, yes. But I will adjust." And then she quoted 1 Corinthians and said, "The greatest of these is love." She said to me, "Love will prevail." And in large measure, it has in my life. So in some ways, what I'm trying to do for my own daughter is to follow the example that my own mother set for me and to allow love to prevail.
You said you think it might have been harder for your daughter to transition because you are trans. Why do you think being trans might have made it harder for your daughter?
As a high-profile transgender activist, I think I can take up a lot of the oxygen in the room. And, you know, certainly within our house, for a long time, I was the kind of example of what it meant to be trans. Well, my daughter's way of being trans is not identical to mine by any means. So I think she had to find room to be not just the woman that she wants to be, but also the kind of to have a transgender experience on her own terms rather than on mine.
Does having a transgender daughter now make you think about generational differences in terms of how the culture responds to people who are trans and how trans identity, our understanding of being trans, has evolved over the years since you started becoming aware of yourself as trans, which was long before you actually transitioned?
Absolutely. I mean, I think for me, when I came out as trans, I felt like I had to spend the better part of a year or two explaining to people what was going on, I was the first transgender person that most people that I knew had ever met or even heard of. I had to explain the situation. And to some degree, I think I spent a lot of time apologizing. I kind of went around and I asked people's permission, which was something my daughter and I think her generation finds absurd. I mean, I think my daughter came out, she announced it on Facebook, and most of her friends were happy for her. And that was kind of the end of the story. And I think for my daughter's generation, being trans is a thing to celebrate. It's a thing that's fun and which brings people a sense of joy at the variety of life and of the different ways there are of being human. That was not my experience. My experience was very much a feeling that it was something I had to explain and almost apologize for. So it's funny, I think about that line from Lord of the Rings, where at the very end, Frodo is leaving. He says something like, "We set out to save the Shire, and the Shire has been saved, but not for me." I hope that through my writing, and I hope you'll forgive what sounds like the egotism of this, but I hope that through my writing and through the advocacy that I've done at GLAAD and in the work I've done in the New York Times, that some of that work has had an effect on making the world a little bit of an easier place for other transgender people and for the next generation in particular. But for me, you know, life has been hard. I mean, life has been joyful too. I'm very lucky and I'm really happy, but it's also been, being trans has been really hard. And there are times when I wish I could live in the world that my daughter lives in, the world that some of this work has brought about.
Now that you've been out as trans for over 20 years, what do you say some of the fundamental differences between living life as a man? You knew that you wanted to transition, but you still, in describing your past, you describe yourself as having lived as a boy and as a man. So what are some of the fundamental differences between having lived in as a man and living for over 20 years as an out woman? Beyond the physical, just in terms of how you see yourself, how the world sees you, how you make your way through life. I know that's a really big question, but I'm sure it's something you've reflected on.
Yeah, I think there's a couple answers to that. I mean, in some ways, the biggest change is not going from male to female. The biggest change is going from someone who has a secret to someone who doesn't have a secret. And if you have a secret that is as profound as the question of who you are, it's something that's going to eat at you all the time. So it used to be I'd wake up in the morning and I'd think, okay, we're going to do the guy thing again now. And now I wake up in the morning and I don't think about it. In a way, gender has become something I think about a whole lot less. I think it's not just the difference between male and female. It's the difference between being young and being middle-aged. And maybe I'm the wrong person to observe those changes. But I try to live my life with courage as best I can. I'll be honest and say that tears lie very close to the surface now when they didn't used to. Maybe it's estrogen. Maybe it's simply being older. Maybe it's having experienced, you know, you live long enough, you end up with a lot of arrows in your side. Whatever the reason, it doesn't take much to get me weeping. And quite often weeping just because something wonderful has happened. So my emotions are definitely closer to the surface, but then everything is closer to the surface, and not only because of hormones, but because I'm living in the world with no secrets.
Jennifer Finney Boylan, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. I wish you and your family well.
Thank you, Terry, and my love to everybody at WHYY and in the Philadelphia area, the place where I grew up and the station that I listen to. It's been an honor to be here with you.
I really appreciate hearing that. Thank you so much. Jennifer Finney Boylan's new memoir is called Good Boy, My Life in Seven Dogs. After we take a short break, our rock critic Ken Tucker will review a new album by Grammy winner Dua Lipa that he describes as something fresh and much needed. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor StoryPoint Wines, maker of StoryPoint, a bold new wine brand with a rich, layered taste profile. Enjoy StoryPoint wine while you connect with those you love, either at home or at a virtual happy hour. Raise a glass and share a story. StoryPoint believes that the stories we share can bring joy even in trying times. Visit StoryPointVineyards.com/fresh air to purchase. Shipping is included in your online order, so consider shipping a bottle to a friend, too.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Scribner, publisher of If It Bleeds by Stephen King. Featuring four new novellas, If It Bleeds is King's collection of stories that will take you to intriguing and frightening places. The novella is a form Stephen King has returned to time and again in the course of his career, inspiring many iconic films. Now joining them, If It Bleeds, new from Stephen King, available now wherever books are sold.
Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of a new album he describes as at once a throwback to disco of the 70s and 80s, but also something fresh and much needed. It's Dua Lipa's second album called Future Nostalgia. She's the daughter of Albanian immigrants raised in England. She won a Best New Artist Grammy last year, and Ken says her artistry has only become more impressive on this new release.
Future. You want a timeless song, I wanna change the game. Like modern architecture, John Lautner coming your way. I know you like this beat, cause Jeff been doing the damn thing. You wanna turn it up loud, future nostalgia is the name. I know you're done trying to figure me out. My name's on the tip of your tongue, keep running your mouth.
Dua Lipa says she had the title Future Nostalgia before she had a clear idea of what her new album would be. The phrase was meant to describe a future of infinite possibilities while tapping into the sound and mood of some older music she loved. What resulted is a collection of very smart, snappy disco compositions that immediately stands out from nearly all current popular music for its sheer bursting joyfulness. For example, I love the crisp authority that runs beneath the dance floor theatrics of this song called Levitating.
If you wanna run away with me, I know a galaxy and I can take you for a ride. I had a premonition that we fell into a rhythm where the music don't stop.
Dua Lipa is only 24, and thus she's experiencing nostalgia for a time, the late 70s and early 80s, that precedes her birth. In some of her vocals, you can hear Madonna in her Like a Virgin period. At other times, I detect the low growl of Donna Summer. The guitars and keyboards are sometimes strongly reminiscent of the great disco band Chic. And I would say that Dua Lipa is a much better singer than Olivia Newton-John, even as she winks at a certain 1981 hit on this new song, Physical.
When I got you next to me.
Much of the vintage disco Dua Lipa is saluting on this album was released in the midst of the AIDS epidemic. Although Lipa recorded her new songs before COVID-19 began shutting down the world, the mood she sustains here, persistence and pleasure placed in opposition to defeat and despair, is both true to its disco roots and also remarkably timely.
Pocket full of-
During this time of distancing and anxiety, I sometimes find it difficult to apply the kind of intense listening I normally do in order to write and talk about music. As I go about my days, I've been drawn to instrumental music, jazz mostly, and Thelonious Monk's piano in particular, but also lots of rhythm-based pop music. George Clinton's P-Funk, Washington D.C. go-go music from the 80s, and a lot of disco. So it's no wonder Dua Lipa's new album caught my attention. It gave me a focus I needed. I'm grateful for that, just as I think a lot of listeners are grateful for Dua Lipa's reminder of how carefree we once were, and maybe yet again.
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed the new album Future Nostalgia by Dua Lipa. The pandemic isn't the end of the world, but your anxiety about the virus may make you feel like it is. And your home may be starting to feel like a bunker. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be Mark O'Connell, author of the new book, Notes from an Apocalypse. It's about people who are preparing for the end of the world as we know it, as a result of a pandemic, environmental catastrophe, nuclear war, comet crash, and how they plan on surviving. It's also a book about anxiety. I hope you'll join us.
Somewhere in the middle, I think I lied a little. I
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
When my mind is running wild, could you help me slow it down? Put my mind at ease. Pretty please. I need your hands on me. Sweet relief. Pretty. Exactly where I want me, yeah.